Support by Denali National Park. Enjoy the views along the way and keep your eyes open for moose, bears, caribou, and 130 different bird species in the park's natural wilderness area. Exploring your home state is the COVID-safe way to enjoy the summer.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Rebecca Nagel. For more than 40 years, legal experts have considered the Indian Child Welfare Act an important law for keeping Native families together. But in the past decade, a collection of special interest groups have worked to undo those protections. And a legal challenge heading to the Supreme Court is the most significant threat ICWA has ever faced. Coming up, we'll learn who is behind the challenges to ICWA and what's at stake. We're back right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Corvallis School District has changed the name of three schools. They now honor people of color. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Last year, the Corvallis School Board approved a resolution to have three elementary schools drop the names of U.S. Presidents Thomas Jefferson, Woodrow Wilson, and Herbert Hoover. All three have pasts involving slavery or racism. The schools are now named for Bessie Coleman, the first black and indigenous woman to get a pilot's license, Letitia Carson, a black woman who claimed land in Oregon despite state laws at the time, and Catherine Jones Harrison of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, who's advocated for the restoration of tribal statuses and lands and education. School Board Co-Chair Lahui Whitebear.
There's a really strong tie to this area and with the local schools, so that's one of the reasons why her being chosen was so significant. Also, just the work that she has done throughout her life.
Among the influences cited for the name change was the Black Lives Matter movement. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The co-creator and cast of Reservation Dogs presented at the 2021 Emmy Awards Sunday night, which aired live on CBS. Clips of their presentation talking about indigenous representation in Hollywood is being shared widely on social media. Co-creator Sterling Harjo took to the stage, saying, "We're here on television's biggest night as creators and actors, proud to be indigenous people working in Hollywood.
Representing the first people to walk upon this continent. And we are really happy to be here.
Thankfully, networks and streamers are now beginning to produce and develop shows created by and starring indigenous people.
It's a good start, which can lead us to the day when telling stories from underserved communities will be the norm, not the exception.
Because like life, TV is at its best when we all have a voice."
The series Reservation Dogs on FX on Hulu follows the lives of indigenous teenagers in Oklahoma. Here's how Sterling Harjo described the series during an interview this summer on the talk show Native America Calling.
"What's amazing about this show is all of the writers and all the creators of the show are Native. And so we weren't afraid to just be like, yo, like, we have interesting lives and we have interesting communities and we celebrate that. And we tell it how it is." And I think that, like, having indigenous creators and indigenous directors, like, and writers, like, I think that they're just like, we were fearless in telling the story of who we are. And it's something that I've always wanted to do. It's something I've always strived to do in all of my work. It's just like kind of like not censoring ourselves because we're afraid of what white America will think about us. It's celebrating the fact that we're different and that our communities are different. Like, that's the element that I feel like is different about this show.
Harjo and actors presented the Emmy for Outstanding Directing in a Limited Series. On Friday, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland signed the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes Water Rights Compact. It formally executes the Montana Water Rights Protection Act, enacted by Congress in December 2020. With the signature, the tribes can now begin to implement the compact. Tribal leaders say the compact will help protect water for future generations to come. Native women's advocates marched to the Navajo Nation Capitol in Window Rock, Arizona, Friday. Advocates are calling on the tribe's lawmakers and leaders to allocate funding to address sexual abuse and missing and murdered indigenous people. Advocates are also seeking the creation of a position to track crimes committed on the reservation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. Support by the Sanosky Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. Goheen Tawadon, I'm Rebecca Nagel, citizen of Cherokee Nation. About 4 years ago, a white couple living in the suburbs of Fort Worth, Texas, wanted to adopt a Native toddler they had been fostering. But the child's tribe, Navajo Nation, had identified a Navajo home, and a federal law called the Indian Child Welfare Act said that's where the child should go. The white couple sued for custody of that toddler, but also to strike down the Indian Child Welfare Act entirely. They won custody of the child, but today their lawsuit is waiting on the steps of the Supreme Court. It threatens the future of ICWA and a whole lot more. We're spending this hour on Native America Calling talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act and the forces who are trying to strike it down. You can join our discussion by calling us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIV. First, we are going to talk about the history behind ICWA and why it is an important law with Sandy Whitehawk. She is the elder in residence at the ICWA Law Center, and she is Sichangu Lakota. Welcome to Native America Calling, Sandy.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's really awesome to be here.
Before the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in 1978, 25 to 35% of all Native children were removed from their families and tribes by the U.S. government. Sandy Whitehawk was one of those children. Sandy, can you tell me about what happened when a social worker came and took you from your family?
Well, like hundreds, thousands of other Indian children, my family was deemed, my mother was deemed unfit to raise me, to take care of me. Ironically, when the social workers did come to get me, according to a story my uncle told, the day that they did come, several of my relatives were sitting outside one of my relatives' homes, and I was just outside toddling around, and a social worker came, probably had her eyes on my mom for a while because she was a single person, and they really did go after impoverished women at that time, and so, or who they saw as impoverished, I should say. Anyway, drove into the driveway, got out of the car, literally just went and picked me up and took me. And when I first heard that story, my heart just broke. Not for me. I had been have a horrible experience after that, but I couldn't imagine what it was like to be young, strong Lakota men watch that. Because if they tried to grab me, if they tried to take me away from her, they would have been arrested, and I still would have been taken away. And so countless families felt that helplessness, that powerlessness, when social workers were intervening. No resources were ever offered. There was just no support for our families whatsoever. We were targeted for removal and used any means to do that.
And one thing that your story highlights, Sandy, that is important to note is that at this during this time, Native children were being removed through two programs. So there was a federal program called the Indian Adoption Project, where the BIA gave the Child Welfare League of America money to place Native children in white homes. But many children were also taken by state agencies and child welfare departments because they had a deep racial bias that white homes were better for Native children than Native homes. Sandy, I was wondering if you could talk about the impact of growing up in a white home. How did it affect your sense of identity and understanding of who you are? And now that you are an advocate, as you have worked with and met other adult adoptees, what things are you hearing from them?
So I wanted to also mention, go back to the Indian Adoption Project, was just that, a project where 395 children were adopted. But the influence that that project had opened up the door and trained private adoption agencies, Lutheran social services, Catholic social services, and other agencies to target us. So I wanted to just clarify that, because I have really actually had people believe that only 395 children were placed, and that is so not true. Nearly one in four children were removed from their homes at that time. And some of the elders I had heard here just in Minnesota talked about in some villages in the north, there were simply no children because so many had been removed. For myself, I grew up in Wisconsin. Eventually, the white family that adopted me were missionaries, and my white mother used to talk about how she and my dad moved from Illinois to South Dakota to work with the Indians, as they called that. And then work with the Indians meant to convert them to Christianity, and I'm not sure what beyond that they really intended, because I know that they saw us as a lesser people. My adopted mom used to say that I came from a pagan people and that I should be lucky that I was placed with them so that I would have a better chance at life. And any negative behavior that was in me was because I was, you know, an Indian. And I would hear phrases, don't grow up to be a good-for-nothing Indian, a good-for-nothing lazy Indian. I heard those phrases from her all the time. And then in my surroundings, most people didn't know where I grew up. The only influence people had or understanding of who Indian people were was TV. So they knew about the Lone Ranger and Tonto, and they knew about all the other cowboy movies. There wasn't any other Indian family. I was the only Indian girl in this small town. And it was really hard to endure the macroaggressions, microaggressions on the regular, and no one to talk to them about. My adoptive mother wasn't any help in that area either. I remember telling her one time that the kids are really picking on me, you know, calling me squaw and calling me names. And she said, I don't know why they're doing that. You know, she said, you don't look Indian, and your hair is not even black. And if you saw pictures of me, my hair was quite black. It was blue-black. The perception of who I was, what I looked like, was so skewed. And so the home, she was abusive in many ways. And she didn't have any real relatives, so I'd never had an aunt, an uncle, grandma, grandpa to speak of. So we were just really in an isolated situation. It was pretty daunting. What I find is that a lot of Native adoptees have similar stories to tell, and a high incidence of abuse in their homes. Certainly no way to navigate all the racism that was taking place. And I guess this is a good time to quickly say, for any adoptee, individual who grew up in foster care, who is listening, you're not alone. You know, we're out here, and your tribe, the people in your tribe, your ceremonial people that of the people that you come from are praying, and they pray every time that there's ceremony. They pray for us. They may not know our name. They don't know to say to know that, but they pray for our people. When they say we ask blessings on the people that they receive what they need and for those to return and those to come home, you are being prayed for. Your well-being is a concern for all Native nations. So I wanted to make sure that you know that and understand that is true. I'm not sure if I answered all your question, Rebecca.
Well, that's a good segue to what I was hoping you could speak a little bit more about, which is as you grew up and reconnected with your own family, you became a national advocate. And I was wondering if you could talk some about the work that you do now, both with Native nations and with adult adoptees who are working to reconnect and heal.
Right. So one of the things that we started some years ago were Truth, Healing, Reconciliation Circles. And we used the stories of adoptees, those who grew up in foster care, and birth relatives to share their lived experience in child protection with those who make decisions about child protection, like judges, lawyers, social workers. It takes the education to another level to understand that there are long-term implications in separating an individual from their family and from their tribe, from their culture. So one of the other things we've done is created a study that has been published, and if anyone wants to find out information about that, they can contact me via email. But we found that out of 95 individuals who answered our survey, that 23 out of 95, you know, 24% experienced sexual abuse in their adoptive homes, 46% experienced physical abuse, and 49% of them experienced emotional abuse in their adoptive homes. And what's really should make us stop and reevaluate adoption is the number of suicides. Of the 95 individuals, 43 contemplated or planned suicide, and 20 of them attempted. That's a horrible number of.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave it there. We're going to take a short break. Sorry to interrupt you, Sandy. I'm your host, Rebecca Nagel. This is Native America Calling. And join us this hour for a discussion about the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Native people needing medical attention benefit from connections to their culture. But Native people are underrepresented in the medical field. We'll talk about the advantages of having a Native perspective in hospitals and doctors' offices, and plans to recruit more Native nurses and doctors. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
This is Native America Calling. Goheen Dawadon, I'm Rebecca Nagel. We're talking about the legacy and future of the Indian Child Welfare Act today, getting both the legal and personal perspective of the more than 40-year-old law. Has ICWA made a difference in your life? You can join our discussion by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIV. Before our break, we were talking to Sandy Whitehawk, who is the elder in residence at the ICWA Law Center in Sichangu, Lakota. Sandy, I wanted to bring you back in to finish your thought about what research has shown about the long-term impacts of adoption on Native children.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What we have to look at and see, we know that the suicide rate is high among adoptees. These numbers aren't a whole lot different than when the Association of American Indian Affairs did a study to demonstrate the same outcomes in supporting the development of the ICWA Act back in the 70s. So we find that they have to experience all this racism. They have to experience that not being able to fit in. And people may think, well, parents' love will fix everything. You know, we just have to love them right. And I've met many homes that where Indians have grown up in who were very loved and experienced conditional love and still experience that deep grief and loss of their identity of who they are, because despite that love, they still don't have an identity. A love does not give you that. That what gives you that is your family, your community, your songs, your ceremonies, and so that you understand who you are, your purpose in life, and gives you an understanding of your identity. Identity is central to our well-being, being able to have that sense of belonging and pride in who you are. So one of the things that we're doing as well is we're on our 17th year of Gathering for Our Children and Returning Adoptees Powwow here in Minneapolis, where we welcome our relatives back to the circle. It doesn't matter if you know what tribe you're from, just know that you're adopted or grew up in foster care or are a birth relative. We have a time of healing and celebration and welcoming them home. Also, I've worked with the White Earth Tribe and my tribe and the Leech Lake community to welcome our relatives back to organize and give time and space for our relatives to process what happened to them and to ask questions about who they are and be taught the language, be told what it means to be from Rosebud, what it means to be from White Earth. So also encouraging all nations to look for their relatives and welcome them home.
Yeah, that's absolutely very, very important work. And while we're talking about the history of why the Indian Child Welfare Act came to be in 1978, we also need to look at what is happening to Native families in foster care today. And joining us to talk about that is Shauna King. She is a parent advocate also at the ICWA Law Center, and she is a citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling, Shauna.
Adosha, hello. Thank you for
Thank you so much for joining us. Before you became a parent advocate and a child welfare professional, you had your own experience with the child welfare system. Can you talk about how you were treated while you were working on reunification with your children?
Sure. I think it's really important just to note that I was a child of foster care that was brought up in the system and then in return turned out to be a parent in the child welfare system. And I think that is something that is true for many Native Americans in the child protection system today, especially because we have a severely high number of Native American children in out-of-home placements. I believe in Minnesota, we're the highest in the whole United States. So for me, being a birth parent in the child protection system, I feel like I wasn't looked at as a mother. I wasn't talked about as a mom. I don't think they looked for dad. And, you know, being under a microscope is hard enough, but it's really hard when you're trying to heal. And healing is messy. And healing, I'm going to tell you right now, is forever. You don't just heal and you're done, but it's always an ongoing thing. But being a part of the system, it was, I had no support from anybody except for my community. And while I was a child growing up in foster care, ICWA did not apply because I do not believe that the system was educated enough to find out if ICWA, if it even asked if ICWA would apply into my case. So ICWA did not apply in my case. So I lost all ties to my community. But as a birth parent, going into a community, and I'm not from Minnesota, I'm from North Dakota, and I had a tribal liaison. And having that tribal liaison in my tribe backing the tribal liaison made such a difference for me. It made a difference because they believed in me, because they kept my ties, because they made sure that my kids had visitations. They made sure that I had visitations. And there was a point in time when the county did not want to provide me visitation because my son is disabled. And it took a lot of money to either get him to me or me to him. And they didn't want to pay it. And my tribe said, you need to do these things. So I feel like if I didn't have the support from my community and me being Indigenous, me being a part of ICWA, I might not be reunified with my kids today. Because I can tell you, my social worker told me 2 weeks before I was reunified that she was not going to reunify me, that my kids didn't want to be with me, and that I needed to figure something out with my life. And if it wasn't for the people in my community to write me letters saying I'm going to be reunified, I would have never gotten into housing. My tribal liaison made an appointment with the county attorney, invited the social worker and other people that were a part of my case, such as the tribal reps and myself, and to talk about like what the future was, because I marked all the check boxes that they wanted, but my social worker still did not want to reunify me. And if it wasn't for my tribe, I would probably not be reunified today. So it's super important to know that that the tribe has a huge say in what happens and how things happen and how they support you as a family.
I wanted to talk more about reunification. So one of the big misconceptions in these high profile ICWA cases like this case that's headed to the Supreme Court that we're going to talk about more in a minute is simply how foster care works. You know, we're told this story that ICWA ripped a Native foster child away from a loving and safe home. But we know that ICWA isn't the only law that says foster children should be raised by family whenever possible, and that the goal of foster care actually isn't for the child to be adopted by the foster parents. Can you talk about the goals of foster care and why reunification is best for all children?
Sure. Okay, so I do a lot of work nationally with birth and foster parent partnerships, and I can say this. When I first started working at the ICWA Law Center, I realized that a lot of foster licensing agencies promised adoption just to be a foster parent, and that needs to change, and it is changing. And in order to be a foster parent, you should say, am I going to work with this birth family? You know, am I going to work with mom, dad, grandma, auntie, uncle, and siblings? And that's huge. And I think that when it comes to the fact of Native American people, we have to consider our history. We have to consider what Sandy had gone through, what I have gone through. This isn't something that happened a long time ago. This happens to people who are living today, and it's traumatic, and it deeply impacts us as people. And we don't want that to continue to happen. So in order to do that, we have programs like Sandy is doing. We have ICWA, but we want to preserve our culture. We want to preserve our culture is our identity. We want to preserve who we are as people. And that's really hard to do because there's so much barriers in being a kinship family or, you know, having Native American foster families. But it's super important because for me, when I was in foster care, I lived in four different foster homes. They were all white. And my aunties tell me to this day, if they would have known that I was in foster care, they would have taken me. But the state didn't do their due diligence in finding any kinship placements for me because ICWA didn't apply because they didn't have any education. I don't think that being in foster care necessarily has to be a negative thing. If a family needs help in healing, especially in our community, in the Native community, we have so much trauma, historical and intergenerational trauma, that we may be in spots where healing is necessary. But if a foster home doesn't necessarily support reunification, then maybe that isn't a very good placement for any child. Because the one thing we want is for families to be reunified. The only reason that they're out of the home is because they may have to be some sort of healing that needs to take place. And I really think that people need to think about it like healing and not like, oh, we need to, you know, make this parent be sober or we need to make this parent get their mental health things. They need to heal. And not only do we, people need to heal, the system needs to heal as well. And so how we think about foster families, which now I think a lot of states have changed to resource families, is growing that family circle. So that family who is taking in our children and that are loving our children up while we're working on ourselves can be a long-term space for that child who's in their home to love and just get to know and be somebody that birth family can maybe say, hey, listen, I need to go to work and I have a half hour in here between. Can you watch the kids? Or just keep that relationship open so that it's not just a foster family. It's a resource thing. It's an extension of family that you may not have anymore because of whatever's going on in life.
Yeah. And we know from a lot of research that those types of placements are not only what's best for the whole family, but also what's best for foster children, and that foster children do best when they stay connected with their family. And those connections are really important because when we look at the data in foster care, we still see huge racial disparities. So the families that are caught up in the child welfare system are disproportionately Black, Native American, and poor. Where you live, Shauna, in Minnesota, Native children have a 1 in 3 chance of entering foster care before their 18th birthday. Native babies have a 1 in 10 chance of entering foster care before they turn 1. For comparison, nationally, white babies have a 1 in 100 chance. A lot of people might hear those statistics and think that means there's higher rates of abuse, but when you look at the underlying reason for those removals, most of those removals are taking place because of neglect. So you are working with families every day as a parent advocate. And I was wondering, as somebody who's working with families directly, if you can talk about some of the ways that you see those racial disparities and biases show up.
Sure. We do have the highest rate of out-of-home placement for Native American children in the whole United States, I think for termination as well. And I think, you know, one thing is that, you know, when you have child protection, you might come in for, you know, one thing and end up having like 10 things to have to deal with before you can reunify with your children or have your case closed. And unfortunately, we have a huge waiting list for almost everything. We just do not have the resources to help families. So prior to COVID, we would wait for, you know, several months before a family could get into treatment or into mental health or into parenting. And now that COVID has happened, we still have that long wait, but now we're doing everything remotely. And sometimes a lot of our families, especially in the Native community, are homeless. And I don't know if you've heard about tent cities, but we have a lot of tent cities. But, like, how are you supposed to access these services if we do not have Wi-Fi? You know, most of our families, if they are involved in ICWA, they do get a phone. They get $30 a month for phone services, but that's not going to cover what they need to do with parenting or their treatment. That's by Zoom. And most of, I think, I would say about 85% of the clients that I work with currently now are homeless, and a lot of them do have to, you know, live in different spaces such as shelters or couch to couch, and that's really hard. I think we find things that I think that really would open up a case in any other spaces except for, like, such as education neglect. I think that if education neglect were to come up, I would hope in my, you know, big picture thing that the school would be giving that family resources and helping them and really would be accountable before calling child protection. So we're not just putting the accountability on a family. We're putting the accountability on spaces like hospitals and schools and other spaces that just tend to just write off a family, which is usually Native American or people of color, because of education neglect. Well, what is the issue that is bringing them in the first place? Is it because they do not have a car and they don't have enough money to get on the bus, or they have to walk their child to there and they worked all night? So there are a lot of things that I think that other spaces would overlook, but in probably, you know, cities like, you know, Minneapolis, North Minneapolis and South Minneapolis, I think schools are much more prone to, and hospitals are much more prone to call child protection prior to, you know, giving resources. And it would be a beautiful thing if we could have communities uplift our families rather than have it before they get to child protection.
Right, rather than being reported. And we know that at every stage of child welfare, from reporting to investigation to removal, those racial disparities for Native families exist. You are listening to Native America Calling. We are spending the hour today talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act. I'm your host, Rebecca Nagel. There is still time to call in if you have a question or a comment at 1-800-996-2848. Hope to hear from you.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects authentic American Indian and Alaska Native artists and craftspeople and their art and craftwork. Under the Act, it is illegal to market art or craftwork misrepresented as American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native made, or as the product of a particular Indian tribe. Reporting potential Act violations can be done at doi.gov/IACB or at 1-888-ART-FAKE, support provided by Indian Arts and Crafts Board.
This is Native America Calling. Goheen Daodon, I'm Rebecca Nagel. There's still time if you'd like to join our discussion about the Indian Child Welfare Act today. It's designed to keep Native families together and has done that for the most part for the past 43 years. Call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIV. We're going to transition now to the reason for today's show, which is that ICWA is under attack. In the last decade, this law, created to prevent family separation in Native communities, has been challenged more times than the Affordable Care Act. One of those cases is now waiting on the steps of the Supreme Court. It threatens not only the future of ICWA, but also the unique political and legal status of our tribes. Joining us to explain the case and its broader implications is Matthew Fletcher. He is a law professor at Michigan State University's College of Law and author of the Turtle Talk blog. He is a citizen of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Welcome back to Native American Calling, Matthew.
Hey, nice to hear from you, Rebecca.
To start off with, can you just tell us about this federal lawsuit? Brackeen v. Holland. What is this case and where did it start?
Well, this case started in Fort Worth, Texas. It is a federal court case brought initially by the state of Texas, joined by the state of Louisiana and the state of Indiana. It is also was joined quickly thereafter by three adoptive couples who were interested in adopting Native children. And the challenge is to the entirety of the Indian Child Welfare Act, what we call a facial challenge. It all must be struck down from their perspective. And it is a broad-based attack on everything that is pretty much settled law in Indian law, from the powers of Congress to pass statutes in Indian affairs, to the ability under the 10th Amendment of states to resist Indian affairs statutes from the federal government. It is a challenge to Indian affairs statutes that involve that create preferences for American Indian people and Indian tribes as a allegedly as violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. And it is an attack on the ability of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and other federal agencies to implement the Indian Child Welfare Act and order states to comply with it.
I want to drill down into one of those specific legal arguments, which is the equal protection argument. The plaintiffs in this case allege that ICWA discriminates based on race because it treats non-Native foster children differently than it treats Native foster children, and it treats non-Native foster parents differently than it would treat Native foster parents. If the Supreme Court agrees with that argument, what's the implication for federal Indian law and other laws that govern indigenous rights?
So if even portions of the Indian Child Welfare Act are struck because the court concludes that it violates the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment or the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, you can imagine a domino effect falling. First of all, what would go next is the Major Crimes Act and the Indian Country Crimes Act and the Indian Civil Rights Act. Those are all statutes that say these statutes apply to, quote, Indians without a definition of what an Indian is. So without a definition, it's up to the courts and the federal agencies to conclude who qualifies for those statutes. And Indian Country criminal jurisdiction is dependent almost exclusively on the ability of a federal prosecutor or a tribal prosecutor to prove that somebody is or is not an Indian. So tribal membership matters, but it's not dispositive. Reservation residency matters, but isn't dispositive. And after Indian Country criminal jurisdiction, I'll just point to what Justice Blackmun said in 1974 in a case called Morton v. Mancari, that if we don't give deference to Congress in terms of how to define who is an Indian or what is an Indian tribe, all of Title 25 of the United States Code, in other words, all of Indian law, becomes suspect.
And like I mentioned before, ICWA has been challenged more times than the Affordable Care Act in the past decade. You know, this case, the Brackeen's case, is not the first of its kind. It's just the most recent lawsuit in a coordinated campaign to strike ICWA down. Matthew, can you talk about who is behind this campaign? Who are the people who have been bringing these lawsuits?
So the main perpetrators are nonprofit organizations, primarily a group called the Goldwater Institute, and others who are tend to be attorneys or private adoption agencies or attorneys representing private adoption agencies. They've been in opposition to ICWA since before there was an ICWA, when Congress was debating what would become ICWA in the 1970s. They were in the forefront of saying, don't do this. You're going to interfere with our ability to participate in the private adoption market, which is a market. It's a $16 billion plus market in babies. So that's the prime opposition. And really since the Supreme Court's last foray into ICWA cases, the 2013 adoptive couple versus baby girl case, they've taken more aggressive steps to find cases, find adoptive couples who want to oppose ICWA, and they filed a smattering of lawsuits all over the country, just looking for a victory anywhere they can find one. The funny thing is, when it was just Goldwater and private adoption agencies, they got absolutely nowhere. They won nothing. But then, a few years back, in this particular case, the state of Texas decided to start up a federal lawsuit to assert its rights as a state. And that changed everything dramatically. They could pick a forum. They could more or less pick the right judge that they wanted, who was a Republican appointee that has no qualms whatsoever about striking down federal statutes. And so they got the right judge. They got the right moment in time to bring a claim. And by doing so, all it took was one sort of chip in the facade. Again, dozens of these cases were more or less summarily dismissed when it was just Goldwater and private adoption attorneys. But once the states got involved, suddenly that which seemed kind of frivolous, scary, yes, but still frivolous, became a serious thing. And here we are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now the case is waiting on the steps of the Supreme Court. We're going to take a caller. Donna is joining us from Alaska and listening to KNBA. What's your question, Donna?
Well, I don't know if I have a question, but I have a comment about I have my grandkids because of ICWA, and when you're battling a court that is not Native and does not understand Native culture, you need something to rely on, and if there isn't ICWA, then there's going to be a lot more abuse of the legal system and Native legal rights. So I'm hoping that people will be able to stand up to the onslaught, because it's just a continual onslaught. And so I'm just thankful that we kind of edged in there before all this other stuff started happening.
Yes, absolutely. I think that one of the custody disputes in the federal lawsuit that's going to the Supreme Court, because of ICWA, a grandmother was able to maintain custody of her grandchild. And so we know that ICWA helps keep Native families together even today. We're going to take one more comment from a caller. We have Kimberly listening in from California. What's your question, Kimberly?
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I am Kimberly Clough, Legal Director at California Tribal Families Coalition. And I don't have a question, just a comment. I wanted to just zero in on the fundamental inequity of tribes not having attorneys in state ICWA cases like the other parties, the parents, the child, the county, that are publicly funded. And so we in California are working on that issue and think that that will be one step, only one, but one important step in leveling the playing field to create equity in the state courts so that tribes have legal counsel to help them protect the complex rights that arise under ICWA, and would certainly welcome any comments as to that as a strategy in trying to level the playing field. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for our call. Matthew, I don't know if you have anything to add. I know that there are a lot of models that are coming out. I think the ICWA Law Center is a great model of a agency that offers a lot of services, including legal help to parents. There are ICWA courts. Can you talk about some of the work that's being done across the country to help with ICWA compliance and making it a more effective law?
I'm sure I can give it a shot. But I wanted to point out one thing, and I appreciate that Kimberly Clough came on to talk about representation in these hearings. When ICWA was adopted in 1978, there were hardly any child welfare hearings in the country where parents were represented, or children had had an attorney. Parents had almost no due process rights after their children were removed. They couldn't look at evidence. They couldn't talk to cross-examine witnesses. They couldn't see the affidavits. They couldn't participate in the hearings. They weren't even given notice of the hearings after their children had been removed. And, you know, months can go by after you're, if you have a child removed, where you don't see them. And, you know, there really is an incredible, there was in 1978 incredible dearth of due process in these cases for parents. And ICWA changed all that. It was the first time somebody with the authority of Congress sat down and said, this is what a child welfare code might look like. And, you know, it really changed dramatically how child welfare hearings were conducted in state courts for Indian and non-Indian children around the country. And that's why it's referred to by the Casey Family Programs as the gold standard. It was the only standard for the longest period of time. Kimberly Kluss brought up a great point, which is ICWA has some gaps in it. It's designed to provide minimum standards, but it's not going to solve everything. It's not going to solve poverty. And, you know, you're still, if you're a parent, you still don't have a constitutional right to an attorney if you're indigent. And I forgot who said it, but when 85% of your the clients were who are parents were functionally homeless, they can't afford an attorney. And in many places, they don't have a right to one. So there's so much more work to do. And I want to point to, you know, Kate Ford's work just on one aspect that she's done, along with some others that work with her, to try to make it so that tribal attorneys in one state can practice in another state where the tribe is a party to a case. They can appear by the phone, and they don't have to, like, take the bar exam before they can show up in court. It's little things like that that matter a great deal.
We have time for one more quick question, Matthew. And what I was hoping you could leave listeners with is a sense of what is next. So this big federal lawsuit, Brackeen v. Holland, has been appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. Texas is involved. These individual plaintiffs are involved. So people who are worried about the future of ICWA and who are also worried about the other implications of this lawsuit, what can we expect in the coming months?
Well, you're going to, until the fall, probably through December and January, there'll be a round series of briefs from all the different parties arguing for and against whether the Supreme Court should take the case. And we'll find out in late fall or January when, and really the winter, when we will, what the court is going to decide to do on this. And to me, that is really the most important stage of the brief. You would think that, hey, when they take the case, everything's going to be argued. The court can decide which cases it takes. And it can also decide which issues that it will address. So if the court says, we're going to take Texas's petition, and we're going to go down the line and decide whether or not Indian law is actually a thing from top to bottom. But if they look at, they decide to focus on the petition of the United States government, which is very focused on only the things that the lower court said was directly unconstitutional, that's a good sign that the court isn't going to consider all of the far-right crazy. But if they decide to bring all of the far-right crazy in, we're in trouble.
Well, stay tuned and stay paying attention. Again, the name of the lawsuit is Brackeen v. Holland. That's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank our guests, Matthew Fletcher, Sandy Whitehawk, and Shauna King. If you'd like to get a more in-depth look at ICWA and this lawsuit, you can listen to a podcast that I also host called This Land. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts from. The first 6 episodes are available now, and we discuss the Brackeen v. Holland lawsuit in depth. Native America Calling is back live tomorrow with a discussion about recruiting Native people to work in the medical field. I'm your host, Rebecca Nagel. Thank you so much for listening and for tuning in. If you'd like to follow Native America Calling, you can follow us on Facebook at Native America Calling. You can also send us an email at comments@nativeamericacalling.com. Thank you.
support by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, presenting The Other Slavery, Histories of Indian Bondage from New Spain to the Southwestern United States, a virtual symposium that considers the hidden stories of enslaved indigenous peoples, focusing on the legacy of Spanish colonization in the Americas and Asia and its impact on what is now the Southwestern United States. Available on demand from September 24th to the 27th at americanindian.si.edu.
Smoking gave me COPD, which makes it harder and harder for me to breathe. I have a tip for you. If your doctor gives you 5 years to live, spend it talking with your grandchildren. Explain to them that your grandpa's not going to be around anymore to share his wisdom and his love. I haven't figured out how to do that yet, and I'm running out of time.
COPD makes it harder and harder to breathe and can cause death. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.